Hi, welcome everybody. Today our guest is Stan Apps, that's A-P-P-S, and he's a poet, originally from Toronto, but lived in many places, including Texas and New York and Jakarta. But he's been in LA for 5 years, and we'd like to welcome him here. He has his MFA from UC Irvine, and man, you have a lot of projects going. Co-coordinator with Ara Shirinyan for the Smell Make Now Press Last Sunday Reading Series, working with Matt Timmons, my co-host, on Insert Press, which is a chapbook press coming up, and has a chapbook out on Ugly Duckling Press called Soft Hands, which is still available for $5 if you go to the Ugly Duckling website, or you can link to it through our website, www.la-lit.com.
And I was going to say that if you're looking for the Ugly Duckling press page, they spell press with a silent E, P-R-E-S-S-E.
That's right.
So if you just Google Ugly Duckling, of course, you get like stories about, you know, animals. But if you Google Ugly Duckling press, you get some other press. So the silent E is essential. But they have an orders page and you can get that book.
Yeah, so go buy some poetry. Dan's also currently working on a little drama called World Muppet Socialism. He has another work completed, The Oracular Vagina, and God's Livestock? What's it called?
God's Livestock Policy. These are all unpublished books. Looking for publishers confused or... or self-defeating enough to want to put them forth. No, I think, you know, they'd make immense profits well into the 50s of dollars for any press willing to put an initial outlay into them.
Stan is a highly prolific writer, so, you know, any press of any stripe or color, he's got something for you, I'm telling you.
How's that for shameless self-promotion?
On LALit.com, we'll have links to some of Stan's blogs, things like that. So come on over to www.la-lit.com, and we'll have some links to Stan's blog projects, and you can kind of surf around and see what he's doing, you know, online.
And today we're going to be looking at one of his more recent works, because he's always working, so there's stuff even more recent than this, but it's called Info-ration, or Info-ration, depending on how you look at it. And it's under review at Omnidon Books. Hi, Stan.
Hi. Yeah, I hope this book gets published. That would be really nice. But if it doesn't, I'll send it to someone else.
Tell us, what does it mean to be, like, under review? What was the process you went through with Omnidon Press?
I sent them some poems, and then they were really nice, and they sent me a letter or an email, and asked for the rest of the book, and I sent it to them, and then you wait. Publishing is about waiting for things to happen.
So you mark off the calendar every day? Omnidon, Omnidon, Omnidon.
No, I never think about it.
Yeah, I guess that's a good policy.
I repress my feelings about possible publication.
That's all right, because you don't repress your feelings in the poetry, right?
No.
Yeah.
I try, maybe. I don't know. I try not to think about my feelings in poetry, but I'm sure they come out. I'm not sure if that's repressing them or what.
I think you have a poem about what to do with your feelings in this book, Inferation. It's one you're not going to read today, but it's a pretty interesting one. Like, where do I put my feelings? And it's a pretty wonderful poem.
Right. I think in that poem I put them in the war or something. But that may have been more ironic than literal. I don't know.
Okay, well, I think we're just going to jump right in, and we're going to hear you read a poem. It's called Costco Entourage Fantasy.
All right. This isn't the most serious poem in the book, but I like it. So, Costco Entourage Fantasy. When I was younger, I always wanted to have an entourage, but then I realized that all the people who I really admired who had entourages were gay. Andy Warhol, Frank O'Hara. So not being gay, I resigned myself to being part of a couple. Ah, the tyranny of models. That's why Whitman says, Mind you, the timid models of the rest, the majority? Long I minded them, but hence I will not, for I have adopted models for myself, and now offer them to the lands. I've also heard it said that if you invited both O'Hara and Warhol to a party, and they came, then you would already have 80 or 100 people. So that reveals what entourages really are, a sort of Costco-size value pack, not of toilet paper or Coca-Cola, but of people. Imagine walking out of Costco with a big plastic bag full of 50 or 60 people, and then the bag breaks, and all the people fall out and start making toasts. Then a warm, buttery, good mood gathers in the parking lot and then subdivides into various vehicles and drives off, following each other, because no one can recall directions. And there's always that one naughty driver who guns it at the red light and disappears. And then you're just a carved-off mood chunk, lost in a region of warehouses and lofts. Alliances form within the vehicle to pressure the driver to stop at various places. Some want Thai food. Some want to go back home to the dusty metal shelves at Costco to be sewn back up into their plastic bag and hibernate and wait for more consumers. And then some want to go dancing briefly and then leave because they don't like that kind of music. When someone has an entourage, does that someone have to go around repairing everyone's feelings? Is having an entourage like having several different Burl friends at once, all of whom want heartfelt tokens? Or is it more like having your emotional life replaced by a clipboard and you spend all night checking people off? Or is the key to simultaneously abuse everyone and to appoint deputies to abuse those who are beneath your notice? I've seen how Warhol's portraits of Marilyn Monroe have a gleam in their eye, like the viciousness of a tropical bird that plans to destroy Granny just as soon as she escapes her cage. After which she, the bird, will become Granny, of course, and settle down beneath quilts and blankets and order on the telephone a large box of new tropical birds to be delivered from Costco and wait and dream of having the sex life that people who admire her wish she had and wait. And when the birds come, feed them only once a month with one smile, one rose, one box of chocolate, and 11 pounds of dry dog food. Warm and surrounded. My favorite song goes like this, warm and surrounded. Entourages are fundamentally anti-democratic, since the focus is on a powerful, magical chieftain, and therefore they belong only in the urban center where the people are squeezed tighter than democracy and the Rolodex of one sweet one will sing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
I wanted to jump in and ask you this question that sort of came up in my mind as I was reading through this manuscript. I once took an economics class, and actually I took notes for an economics class because I used to be a note taker, and I remember the instructor saying, sort of burned into my mind, that the United States doesn't have a culture, we have an economy. And these poems really struck that chord with me, and this one in particular, and I was hoping you could maybe talk about culture and economy and the United States and the things that come up in this book.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think that this book has a lot of cultural references. You know, there's like Warhol's Marilyn Monroe portraits, and there's the big quote from Whitman, and I drop Frank O'Hara's name. But it's it's true that America's interest in culture tends to be like a sort of subculture in a way. So it's like the kind of cultural things that in a smaller country, especially a European country like you know, Austria or Belgium or something, that would be considered the national culture, here are like this minor subculture that is contained within, you know, a small number of cities, which I guess is why this poem winds up focusing on city life and the urban.
And you're kind of filtering it through this absurd notion of going to Costco and consuming, you know, consuming culture. It's like, or creating instant culture by going to Costco and buying a culture. Whereas, you know, most people would say that you know, culture in America is essentially just consumer culture, right? And maybe that's too easy of a, you know, of a, I don't know, as a stab at America, but yet.
Right. Well, I guess the idea of buying people comes into the poem. Buying people, buying relationships with people. And, you know, and the other person I was really thinking about when I was doing the poem was Puff Daddy, who I don't mention. I would have mentioned him at the beginning as someone who had a great entourage, but he's not gay, so he would have queered my thesis, as it were. Sorry, that was too many puns at once. But because I was reading when Puff Daddy was on trial, there were all these moments in the trial, I guess. This is from an Adam Gopnik New Yorker article, where he would be described by his bodyguard as consorting with his entourage. Like, they were in the club, you know, that was going to become a crime scene, a shooting, and the bodyguard would be asked, what did Mr. Combs do at that time? And he would say, well, then he consorted with his entourage. And so there was this, and then in his case, you know, it's all, you know, money is very important, right? So I thought there's this idea with an entourage that you're sort of throwing money around. And I'm sure, well, actually, I'm not sure that was true with Andy Warhol's, and with Frank O'Hara's, he didn't have any money, so. But I guess it's that, you know, this image of like having an entourage then is projected as being part of rap music and other things that are successful in culture. And then the image is sort of sold to people. So I thought, you know, why buy someone else having the image? Why not just go to Costco and buy your own?
Which is funny how you link this to, in the last stanza of the poem, you call it fundamentally anti-democratic, which basically you're saying that, I mean, in a way you're saying that buying culture is fundamentally anti-democratic, the consumer culture is fundamentally anti-democratic, which is a really interesting idea that maybe we don't want to get into yet and like let develop as we talk more about some of these other poems. But I don't know, do we want to move on? I think we were going to read a set of poems, like four poems, or maybe three. What were they? I Object to the Terms Which We Agreed, Facts Are Unfriendly and Unprovable, and or maybe it was just those two. Oh, The Word Is Going to Become a Country is somewhere in the middle there.
All right, so I guess I'll do the first couple. This poem doesn't have a title, but it's titled by the first line. I object to the terms which we agreed. I didn't know what they meant. And besides, I needed the money right away, then, in my combat kitten laughing. Don't say you want anything. Sew the deal up. Get the payment pumping so you can go out to the place where people squeeze in to get loosened by imbibing toxins that confuse in a laughing combat kitten zone. Don't indicate you see it as a contest. Act like for you it's a simple procedure, like parallel parking. You have to be attentive to it, sure, but if there are problems, you withdraw and try again. When actually the silverware drawers and stars. Figure out what you can lose and make no reference to it. Talk and talk about what you can win. Maybe it will make more prestige, more bulbous. The people who you see as children now are stronger and faster and more stamina'd than you, but you have them buffaloed. There's a universe in place, you kids. running in sideways in the squeezed god, parallel parking in a worn silver kitten, confused in the prepaid laughing. I object to the terms which we agreed, when actually I was only pretending to not be threatened. I want to admit belatedly to how you were threatening me in my mobcat Knitta Hingaloo with my igloo on the oceans of the sun.
That's great.
Thanks. That's a lot like the last one, I guess, in terms of a lot of references to money, 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 money. And this next one does not have references to money. This is about something else that makes the world go round.
That's amazing. No references to money. That's great.
Maybe it does, actually. I said that before. I looked at it.
You're fundamentally anti-consumerist. Yeah.
Except I want people to consume my books. It's a painful paradox. The word is going to become a country. It is going to lasso you. I know you prefer that television because of the convenient element in that. It bribes you with autopsy unexposed. It brides wet visions of stuttering families suturing an adolescent surgery. Okay, whereas what I do is conventionally boring without any visual to speak of. The word is going to gather you like a ranched lasso. Like a complete opinion in a tent of all known facts. The word is going to speak through you, work through you, look through your eyes at books full of their own, in order to reproduce habits of information through you.
Yeah, I wanted you to read this poem because it seems so fundamental to the whole... the title, the information, the you know, producing habits of information through you.
That one was, you know, having lived in Texas for a while and, you know, country preachers and all that. And I had this sense when I moved to California that I was escaping Texas, but then, you know, George Bush took over. So sort of Texas follows in a way, not much, but so I was trying in this poem to sort of take on some of this preacher voice that, you know, because I figured America loves being preached to so much that I should take that on. But then I wanted to talk about what I cared about, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. Yeah, no, I like it. You know, I wasn't thinking about religion when I've read this poem like four times. I wasn't thinking about religion, and it's because, you know what? I miss things very often, but otherwise, you know, I'm sorry, but there is some money in this one. It bribes.
Bribes.
Yeah, but that's all right, you know. I'm just giving you a hard time.
So I'm curious because, you know, I know what I was doing when I was writing it, but it doesn't make you think about religion. What does it make you think about?
Well, you know, I get the preachy tone. What it makes me think of is, I'm thinking of a certain mode of poetry that is like, you know, this is the poem, this is what I'm doing. And I felt like you were kind of, you know, this is the word. And I thought you were being simultaneously kind of ironic about that. And yet at the same time, like, very sincere. And I, personally, I am always interested where the sincere and the ironic kind of collide. So, or the honest and the parodic collide. I'm always interested in, like, where those things happen. And I think that you do that, well, in a lot of your poems, but I think here kind of, you know, especially so.
For me, it was more talking about the prepackaged word in terms of our geopolitical economy here and how it sort of creates a system of domination where the word is going to speak through you, work through you, look through you in order to reproduce habits of information through you. So, in a way, you know, a mechanization of not just the word, but people speaking the word, people talking, habits of speech that you hear people saying that they get from television or what other people have said or.
Cool.
Yeah.
There's so many things going on, and you didn't even know it.
I mean, I guess I am sincere about it. I called my friend, a friend of mine in Texas, right after I wrote this, and I read it to him, and he was like, "So you want people to read, right?" So I guess I'm sincere. I think the kids should read.
I was gonna say, I didn't think you really promoted literacy at all, Stan. I thought you were totally against that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this book was about anti-literacy.
Right, that's why I took the word information and I took out a letter to make it less literate. Yeah. Yeah.
That's heavy.
It's heavy.
Well, do we want to... Okay, look, maybe we should move on to facts that are unfriendly and also unprovable, those darn facts.
Okay, yeah. This is... Well, people care less about, I don't know if people have ever cared that much about facts, but, you know, the Bush administration actually feels a freedom to manufacture facts. That's obviously been remarked on a lot. So this is a relatively unoriginal poem that comments in a redundant way upon that. but maybe, you know, but it's good to repeat things because otherwise, you know.
We forget them.
Right. Reproduction. Yeah. Facts are unfriendly and unprovable. The meaning of a fact is unknowable. The status of a fact is like a rock among rocks. A fact is a measurement of frequency. A fact is a measurement of repetition. A fact is eager to be again correctly. The grass does not stop the fact of the ground. The fact of the grass comes out of the fact of the ground. The fact is that there are real lies that can be cataloged. The fact that a fact is a lie is a fact. It is absolutely a fact that the fact of that lie is. Facts can be cataloged according to the opinions they support. Oh, the truth shall never be known unless it comes from somewhere beyond evidence. Anyone can be tricked by a falsehood made from many facts. It takes a committed person to be tricked by falsehoods made of loyalty. Loyalty is my preference for our facts over their facts. The interpretation of the meaning of a fact is an opinion. Failure to recognize or remember a fact is an opinion, too. Even a sucker has a valid opinion because his rights. The right to believe that a lie is a fact. The right to believe that a fact is a lie is a fact. All opinions are valid demonstrations of loyalty. A fact is a measurement of repetition, frequency, and opinion. 100 times over, 100 times over, 100 times over known. A fact is eager to again be known in its interpretable splendor with its unfriendly implications to be tamed by loyalty. It is disloyal to consider the facts within speeches to be rocks in a lung, rocks in a cloud, rocks knocking into words like are me. Are me is pressing at the malevolent, disagreeing presences. It is not time for cynicism. You have the wrong paranoia. You need to get your paranoia looked at, get it replaced. The wrong paranoia creates the wrong panorama, fleshed surround sounds. The skinny do not consider cynicism. They are in search of ideals. People who listen to people are not cynical, they are bored. Unless we are careful, there is no place for facts in human self-inspection loops. I judge the fact by the person who is offering it. Am I them? And if not, they had better be better than me, while being worse than me, and also very equal. If I am them, why are they talking and I'm listening? I would speak, but they know what I would say and agree. This is a form of boredom that excludes loneliness. How can you possibly be lonely with your equals speaking? Cynical people are often lonely because when people instinctively disagree with the facts as your heart presents them, repetition shines like a hand of gentle reaching. Frequently, optimism overcomes through averageness. People who listen while being bored prefer the good to be reached by inaction.
Right on. Thank you.
I totally agree with everything you just said.
I wonder if you could talk about this line. It really hit me when I first read this poem. Oh, the truth shall never be known unless it comes from somewhere beyond evidence.
Right. Well, that's the problem with people who base their ideas or their philosophy, like if they base it really strongly on something that's supernatural, you know, then their evaluation of facts, within that evaluation, it's always this one supernatural thing, or maybe many supernatural things, always have the trump card. So it's like whatever facts you hear, you know, this some sort of supernatural notion is going to be more true. So that's like this whole, you know, religious people, the truth comes from their ideology, you know. I mean, maybe for me, I don't know. I mean, I hope that my ideology is not something that can't be challenged by the facts. I mean, my ideology is something that is pretty able to interpret facts as I like, I guess. Was that an answer at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, just the way you're talking about it now, I mean, sometimes I think on the page, this poem, it may be hard to tell for some people when you're being a little bit more kind of, it's like you're speaking in a few different voices at once. When you read it, I mean, I felt like I could get that more clearly. And I also hit on the same line, which I thought was really interesting, that, you know, something beyond evidence, that kind of thing. But I think that it does kind of get at, you know, the way that we allow our ideologies to find that a fact is a lie, which is a fact, and it's a lie that's a fact, that kind of thing. So,
well, I guess I feel a lot of pathos in that line, actually, because I understand why people want something safe. They want something they can really rely on. They want something to believe. And I'm sympathetic to that. And I understand, you know, the world's it's often an awful place. It's complicated. People say conflicting things. You want to be able to understand what's happening. But it's like if you think about it politically, for example, it's a real weak point that people have, because it's exactly the place, their desire to have something they can really trust, where they can be grabbed and manipulated, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's another line that Stephanie had marked while you were reading. It is not time for cynicism. You have the wrong paranoia. And for some reason, I feel like that connects to what you were just saying.
Right. Well, I often feel that, you know, the there's a lot of paranoia in the media now, of course, about concepts like the liberal media. And maybe that's like fading out now because the Republicans are so powerful, so it seems silly. But, you know, since so many people have been trained to have this particular paranoia over the last while, it's going to take a while to die out if it does. So people have been trained, you know, by like, say, listening to Rush Limbaugh or something, and especially in the middle of the country, you know, they've been trained to be like totally paranoid when they encounter what are in fact pretty mainstream corporate accounts of reality, and be like, oh, that's like totally controlled by an evil other. So then I know that I have my own paranoia. Like, I tend to have this account of reality, which I have to put in check, you know, myself sometimes, where like, you know, corporate forces are kind of controlling culture, and you know, and they want to do things that benefit them, and they don't care about me, and they're going to do bad things to me. So then it's like, I feel like my paranoia is so outnumbered currently by this other paranoia, you know. And I think, you know, like the kind of paranoia I have, you know, if you go back a few generations, it was one generation, you know, to my mother's generation, it was very common paranoia, you know, like your hippie felt a deep paranoia that corporations were trying to trick them. And that paranoia is still true, it's still valid, but, you know, there's this new paranoia, the mainstream. It's really the same paranoia. I mean, they're afraid corporations are trying to trick them, too. They just think that they're controlled by liberals.
Also, I think, in terms of this piece, too, that there's a considerable paranoia generated by the pilfering of facts. You know, we hear constant scientific studies, right? On, if you read the newspaper or listen to the radio, constant. We have found that daydreaming is linked to Alzheimer's disease. We have found that, you know, any number of things, which, you know, creates, like, not just paranoia about what the evil other is doing, but paranoia about what nature may be doing to you, too, as, you know, until you feel sort of sick. Or I do, anyway.
Right, right. And it's good,
like,
to be
facts
cautious.
Facts are paranoid, sorry. Like, facts are paranoid themselves.
Right. I don't know how far I should get into paranoia as a metaphor. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying, like, you know, that I'm certifiable, or that someone who listens to Rush Limbaugh is certifiable for that reason. I mean, there's, you know, this is another sense of paranoia rather than. But I think when you live in a complicated culture, you know, of course you have some kind of paranoia that motivates your politics. You're afraid of someone, you know. If you weren't afraid of anyone, I think you probably wouldn't have strong political opinions. You'd probably sort of settle and be like, oh, you know, all's for the best. You know, I like, if you trusted the government, if anyone who trusts the government isn't like a conservative or a liberal, they're like a moderate. They trust the government automatically.
Well, maybe we should move on to another set of poems.
Okay.